Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Thursday, March 14. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette, Tree of Five Seasons to be Transplanted, this story by Marissa Payne for the Gazette. The Tree of Five Seasons monument near City Hall will be moved a short distance this spring as part of Cedar Rapids' permanent flood control system construction. While weather may play a factor in exactly when the monument is moved, project managers are targeting a late May timeline for moving it approximately 80 feet east of the current location, on the east bank of the Cedar River, closer to First Street Northeast. Additional site work such as grading is needed before the monument is moved. New footings also are needed for the monument at its new location, Assistant Public Works Director Brenna Fall said in a statement. The Tree of Five Seasons will remain on site, staying in its current spot until crews are ready to move it directly to its final position. The sculpture will be elevated and realigned to accommodate a flood wall as a segment of the city's $750 million permanent flood protection system. There will be no additional traffic impacts when the monument is moved. A crane will be used and contained within the current construction area. However, First Street Northeast will continue to be reduced to one lane during overall project construction. The monument, built in the 1990s, is a representation of the city's logo representing the city of five seasons, the fifth season being time to enjoy life and find beauty in every day. In 1968, Chamber of Commerce Publicity Chair E.W., known as Bill Munsell, had to come up with a promotional idea to attract new residents to the city. The Gazette previously reported he was executive vice president of the firm Cresswell, Munsell, Schubert, and Zerbel. Munsell, together with the film's art director Gary Anderson and writer Ron Howes, came up with the City of Five Seasons logo and the tree logo. Overall, Fall said the project near First Avenue and First Street Northeast will cost $30 million. In addition to transplanting the monument, this project will bring a permanent full-height flood wall from First Avenue to Interstate 380 with an elevated park allowing views of the river and shielding the flood wall from view. It includes construction of a $10 million pump station at A Avenue Northeast, as well as roller gate installation at E and F Avenues underneath I-380. Sidewalk construction and site restoration also are covered in this project. Flood Control System Program Manager Rob Davis has said a bike trail along the part of First Avenue Northeast will add a connection running under I-380 from the west side to the east side, running on the banks of both sides of the Cedar River. The park also eventually will have new landscaping and tree plantings. Other flood control projects have finished nearby recently. Work wrapped up last year on a roller floodgate at First Avenue East, similar to the 16th Avenue Southeast roller gate. During flood events, the $4.125 million Army Corps roller gate will roll across the road, close, and lock into place to keep water out. It is 12 feet high, 82 feet long, and weighs 57,000 pounds. Also on the front page, this story by Aaron Jordan, AgriStar dumps wastewater in city sewer system and creek. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is considering citing a kosher beef and poultry processing in Postville after the company last week sent more than 250,000 gallons of untreated food processing waste into the city's sewer system. Wastewater, including blood from AgriStar's beef processing facility, went into Williams Creek before Postville city staff discovered the problem and diverted the water into a holding tank and alerted AgriStar. The city caught it early and we were able to isolate it, said Shane Dodge, supervisor of the Iowa DNR's Manchester field office. Any action we would take would likely be against the industrial user. We have rules that prevent them from sending effluent that could cause an upset to the city's plant. Postville city staff noticed an unusual cleaning product smell in the water treatment plant March 2nd and 3rd, and a sample of water coming into the plant March 4 was a dark red color, according to a report Postville sent the state this week. City staff also saw red-tinted water in Williams Creek, a tributary to the Yellow River. AgriSAR staff were contacted immediately, and both the head of maintenance and the industrial wastewater plant operator stated they were unaware of any issues within their system that would be contributing process waste to the city system, Postville reported to the Iowa DNR. About an hour later, AgriSAR officials told Postville officials they discovered they had a blocked sewer line leading from the beef kill facility to AgriSAR's own industrial treatment plant, and the basement was flooded. The basement is where the plant has a lift station that pumps some wastewater from offices and restrooms to the city. The rest of AgriSAR's waste is supposed to be treated at the company's industrial plant. As AgriSAR worked to fix the problem, processing waste continued to flow to the city at a rate of 148 to 164 gallons per minute, Postville reported. At no time did they appear to cease or limit production, the city told the Iowa DNR. Based on plant influent meter reading, or excuse me, meter trending, it appears that over 250,000 gallons of untreated industrial waste entered the city's domestic sewer treatment plant between March 4 and March 5. Postville diverted treated water away from Williams Creek from March 4 to March 7, when the water had just faint pink tints and ammonia levels were back to normal range, the city reported. The city expects full recovery at the plant will take a month and will require additional costs of labor, power, lab testing, and sludge hauling. The fact that it appears it took AgriSAR at least 2 days to realize and did not report until prompted by the city that they had a severe blockage that was discharging to the city system is alarming, Postville officials told the state in the report. The city recommends AgriSAR be required to install a transmitter at the meter site to monitor the flow, with alarms to city staff when flows exceed normal levels. Postville also wants the company to verify places in the plant wherein domestic and industrial waste streams could converge and train staff how to quickly report and repair blockages. Postville and AgriSAR did not immediately return messages Wednesday seeking comment. AgriSAR processes beef and poultry according to a dietary standard called kashrut, which dictates what some Jewish people may eat and how foods must be prepared. The company has a staff of rabbis and ritual supervisors who ensure products meet requirements for kosher certification, the company's website says. AgriSAR opened in 2009 at the site of the former Agriprocessors, Inc. Canadian business owner Hershey Friedman bought the plant and invested $7.5 million to modernize and upgrade before reopening, the Gazette reported in 2010, 2 years after a massive immigration raid at Agriprocessors. Friedman told Forward.com in 2016 the facility was processing about 50,000 birds a day, primarily chickens. He said the plant can slaughter 400 cattle in a day, but often processed fewer because it was looking for quality beef from within a 100-mile radius. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, lawmakers pause effort to restrict DNR land purchases, this by Caleb McCullough. A bill that would limit the authority of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to purchase land for public use was shelved Wednesday ahead of a key legislative deadline. The House State Government Committee opted not to advance the bill, making it unlikely to become law this year. Still, the committee's vice chair left open the possibility of the bill having some life left, noting that nothing's ever dead in this building. Senate File 2324 would have banned the DNR from purchasing land at an auction and from receiving donated land from a nonprofit that bought it at an auction. Dozens of outdoor enthusiasts came to the Capitol this week to protest its passage. Supporters said the bill would allow Iowa farmers to more easily buy land without competition from the state. Representative Austin Harris, a Republican from Moulton, wrote the House version of the bill and is vice chair of the State Government Committee. He said some Republican lawmakers were skeptical ahead of Wednesday's committee meeting. There were some concerns shared by some members as of right now, so we decided to pull the bill for today, Harris said. We'll see what future avenues exist moving forward. But for today, we're just putting a pause on the bill. The bill likely will not clear this week's legislative funnel deadline, which requires it to pass out of a House committee to be eligible for consideration going forward. The Senate approved the bill last month. Harris said the DNR already has a policy of not purchasing land at auctions, and the bill would simply codify that agency rule. He said during a subcommittee meeting Tuesday that the opposition was motivated by scare tactics. This bill will not change a single thing. It does not threaten public land any more than the current policy does, he said. During a subcommittee hearing Tuesday, conservation groups, hunters, and other outdoors enthusiasts said they worried the bill would limit options for outdoor recreation. Rod Marlott, chair of the Fayette County Conservation Board, told lawmakers that outdoor recreation is a tourism draw. Recreation opportunities are the top reasons for visitors to come to Iowa and subsequently to move to our state, he said. Today's visitors are tomorrow's residents. Beyond that, our public lands also retain residents, both young and old. About 1% of Iowa's land is public and available for use by Iowans, according to the DNR. Lawmakers have tried to restrict the state's ability to buy land for several years. A bill last year that would have required the state to prioritize maintenance of existing land over purchasing new land failed to pass. The Iowa Farm Bureau Federation was one of the groups that spoke in favor of the bill Tuesday. Kevin Kuhl, a lobbyist for the group, said the bill would mean farmers are not competing with the state for land that has risen dramatically in value in recent years. Kuhl noted, though, that the DNR's current policy means they are not competing with farmers at auctions. In the past, our farmers have had concerns about government involvement competing against farmers for land purchases, he said. We appreciate that the state has stated that they are largely not competing for land. Competition isn't the goal. Fred Long, president of the Iowa Conservation Alliance, said high farmland prices, not DNR competition, is preventing small and beginning farmers from buying land. Iowa's farmland prices reached a historic high in 2023 at $11,835 an acre, according to Iowa State University. The young guy that's getting started, he doesn't have the money to wait 30 years to get a profit, so that's why he can't get started, Long said. Also in Iowa Today News, Duval Walker guilty in Marion Barr shooting, this by Trish Mahaffey. A Cedar Rapids man will spend the rest of his life in prison for fatally shooting a man after picking a fight with him on St. Patrick's Day last year at a Marion Barr. A Linn County jury deliberated less than 2 hours Wednesday before convicting Duval T. Walker, Jr., age 30, of first-degree murder and going armed with intent in the fatal shooting of Cameron Barnes, age 32, of Cedar Rapids. Walker showed no visible reaction when the verdict was read, and the jurors were polled individually to confirm their verdict. Before his trial, which started last Tuesday, Walker pleaded to one of the charges filed in the case, possession of a firearm by a felon. He faces life without the possibility of parole on the murder charge. His sentencing is set for April 26th at Linn County District Court. Abbreviating that story, I'll move on to this one. Jury acquits demonstrator charged after UI protest. A Johnson County jury Wednesday found a transgender musician and community activist not guilty of two misdemeanor charges of disorderly conduct and interfering with officers during a protest at the University of Iowa last October. The jury deliberated about 3 hours following about a day of trial testimony. Gina Messamer, the lawyer for Tara Dutcher, 45, of Coralville, didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Johnson County attorney Rachel Zimmerman Smith confirmed the sealed verdict, which is the procedure in misdemeanor trials when verdicts are not read in public court. The verdict should be filed online later. Being a juror is hard work, Zimmerman Smith told the Gazette after the verdict. We respect the jury's decision and thank them for their service. The defendant got a fair trial, and regardless of the outcome, that is always the ultimate goal. Dutcher, who uses they-them pronouns, testified earlier Wednesday about their role in the demonstration at the UI. Dutcher said they didn't block a lane of traffic that officers wanted cleared for vehicles and instead stayed in a crosswalk. Dutcher joined the protest rally before the event started at 7 p.m. to support transgender individuals protesting the speaker, Chloe Cole, on October 16, 2023, at the Iowa Memorial Union, and those who attended the event who would be leaving after 8 p.m. Dutcher testified they understood protesters could walk in a circle, staying in the pedestrian crosswalks at the Madison and Jefferson Streets intersection. The group was walking for about 20 minutes before UI police officers tried to move Dutcher and the others. Dutcher said they didn't like that Lieutenant Travis Tyrell, a UI police investigator who testified Tuesday, was grabbing and pushing people. Dutcher felt a responsibility to speak up and tell Tyrell and the other officers not to touch the protesters. Dutcher, by going to trial and not taking a plea agreement, was testing Iowa's law on public protests, which was enacted as part of the Back the Blue laws in Iowa and 16 other states following demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota in 2020, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Iowa's law expanded protections for drivers who hit protesters in a street. Dutcher was arrested with six others. Five of those charged pleaded to simple misdemeanors and received probation and deferred sentences. Tyrell testified Tuesday that he regarded Dutcher as being in a leadership role because Dutcher had a confrontation with him and also told other protesters to stay in the group or in line when Tyrell and other officers tried to clear one lane for traffic. Dutcher, who carried a trans colors flag and a pride flag, testified they weren't a leader of the demonstration and the decision to march in a circle in the intersection wasn't Dutcher's. Someone else yelled, "Stay in the group," Dutcher testified. When a surveillance camera video was played Tuesday, Tyrell pointed out that incident and said Dutcher gave that command. The video was played during Dutcher's testimony on Wednesday, but they denied it was them giving that command. Dutcher said the concern was over Tyrell touching, pushing, or grabbing people. Dutcher also was concerned because another officer who used abusive language had pushed protesters at previous events and was pushing people at this one. Dutcher said they didn't want to have any interaction with police and hadn't in the past, but felt it was important to speak out when police were hands-on with individuals. Dutcher said they were familiar with protesters' rights and had learned about them through research on the ACLU website. Dutcher said police didn't give an order for the protesters to disperse, and so they didn't. Dutcher recorded officers when they started touching people with the intent to document the behavior. A video shows Dutcher holding up a phone and confronting Tyrell as he asks protesters to move out of the lane of traffic. In the video, the officer is touching the shoulders of protesters to get them to move. Tyrell grabbed Dutcher's wrist, which Dutcher described as a strong grasp. Assistant Johnson County Attorney Jacob Benke asked if Dutcher had videos of the other officer being abusive in the past or if that is part of a trial exhibit. Dutcher said no. Dutcher denied wanting any interaction with police, only to raise attention to transgender issues. The defense rested Wednesday after Dutcher's testimony. Sixth Judicial Associate District Judge Jason Burns denied the defense's motion for a directed verdict because of insufficient evidence. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from Wednesday's New York Daily News, and the title is A Strong Start to a Long Campaign. With a 1-2 punch, the incumbent president made a strong case for his reelection, especially given that the alternative is a man who seeks to overturn the results of Democratic elections, who's champing at the bit to punish his political enemies, and who says immigrants are vermin. The first Joe Biden punch landed Thursday night when he delivered a forceful State of the Union address, pushing back on many of Donald Trump's lies and distortions. In contrast to Trump, whose only policy in the Middle East is that Israel should finish the problem, Biden wants a ceasefire to get the hostages out of Gaza and get needed humanitarian aid into Gaza, backing Israel's right to defend itself. He also wants to prevent unnecessary bloodshed. In an attempt to undercut those who say he's too old, Biden smartly linked his 81 years to some of his obvious strengths, being a decent and dignified person, while reminding people that the also elderly man he's running against traffics in resentment, revenge, and retribution. Sure, if this were a theater review, we would care a bit more about the fact that Biden flubbed some lines, but he's never been a great big stage performer. And the ability to stir people to stand and clap is just one small attribute of a leader. It matters far, far less than the ability to surround oneself with good people and consistently exercise good judgment on big, tough questions. This brings us to the second punch in Biden's combo. It came Friday morning in the latest Labor Department report on the single most important indicator of the health of the U.S. economy. Employers produced 275,000 new jobs in February, a very good sign that growth is continuing at a healthy pace and wages are still rising even as inflation edges lower. That brings to 15 million the number of jobs created under Biden. Contrast that to Trump, the first president since Herbert Hoover, to leave the nation with fewer jobs than when he took office. Trump's disastrously flat-footed, know-nothing response to the pandemic was one of the core reasons the economy seized up. Biden isn't the perfect candidate. The coming months will test him politically, but anyone sane and honest must admit that he's notched a series of major legislative victories, and anyone sane and honest must admit that the dangerous man who's desperate to return to power is a vendetta in search of an agenda. 24-hour Doorman today is titled, Cedar Rapids Needs to Get Off the Fence. Sometimes you've got to pick a side. Sure, it can be more comfortable in the middle of the road, but as Texas journalist Jim Hightower once said, the middle of the road is for yellow lines and dead armadillos. That's where the city of Cedar Rapids finds itself in the debate over a bill in the legislature banning citizen police review boards. It would undo all the hard work put in by local police, city leaders, and advocates for social justice to form a Cedar Rapids review board in the wake of the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police in 2020. Cedar Rapids' two lobbyists are registered as undecided on the bill. Not for it, but also not against it. For advocates who lead peaceful protests and believe the city was on their side, it doesn't make sense. We find that registering as undecided on developing legislation provides greater opportunities for the city to share and listen to our lawmakers, keeping the door open to positive conversations while legislation develops, said City Manager Jeff Pomerantz in a statement answering ASJ concerns. I'm calling BS on that one, Ann Carter, a member of ASJ, told the City Council on Tuesday. The Republican-controlled legislature is going to do what it wants, no matter how Cedar Rapids lobbyists register. The bill's backers have, wrongly, portrayed review boards as part of some leftist plot to undermine law enforcement. So registering against the bill would be a symbolic gesture. But symbolic gestures do matter. Being squarely against the bill sends a message to local advocates the city remains in their corner. Undecided sends an ambiguous message regardless of whether it's good strategy. The city has registered against other bills. The city is against multiple bills seeking to get rid of automated traffic enforcement. The city also opposed a bill that would bar local governments from enforcing rules on building exteriors and another that alters the way parking meters operate. It's no secret two of the biggest items on the city's legislative to-do list are stopping a traffic camera ban and heading off an extension of a moratorium on new casino licenses. Maybe the city doesn't want to alienate Republicans by opposing the review board bill. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell insists those issues have had no bearing on the city's review board stance. She said she favors keeping the board in place. "I think it has worked really well in Cedar Rapids," O'Donnell said. "I do believe it is a best practice." In 2020, lawmakers unanimously approved police reforms amid protests, and the governor signed them on the Capitol steps with social justice advocates standing behind her. A year later, the governor signed a Back the Black bill that cracked down on protests. "We've been backsliding on justice reform ever since." Cedar Rapids has been a success story since its Citizen Review Board began its work in 2021. Now a bill scrapping all that progress is one House vote away from the governor's desk. The time for neutrality is over. "The stakes are too high and the cost of inaction is too great," said State Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat from Cedar Rapids. "It's time, past time, to pick a side." And that is 24-hour dormant. We have one community letter today. "Defense spending is funding pricey wish lists." In 2017, Congress passed the National Defense Authorization Act, requiring chiefs of staff of the military services to submit lists of their unfunded needs so that money could be found to pay for these needs. Later, defense bills have expanded this requirement to other defense agencies and components. These wish lists, known as the unfunded priority lists, allow the military to increase their budgets. Submitting these wish lists is a requirement of the 2017 law, even though this process circumvents the normal budgeting process. In recent years, these unfunded lists have added up to more than $20 billion a year. There is a bill before Congress, H.R. 4740, to drop these extra budgetary wish lists. This bill has bipartisan support and the support of Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. We can probably all agree that current federal deficits are large and we need to spend our money wisely. It is time to repeal the laws which require Congress to spend our money without their review. At this time, we should encourage our congressional representatives to support H.R. 4740. By passing H.R. 4740, Congress will regain more control over the federal budget. That letter today is signed by George Burgess from Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, March 14, on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First, in Cedar Rapids, Casey James Drew, age 54, died Monday, March 11. Entrusted with the arrangements is Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. In Clarence, Bryson Crayfock, visitation will be on Saturday, March 16, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Chapman's in Clarence. And in Waukon, David Joseph Kupka, 80, died Tuesday, March 12, Martin Graw Funeral Home in Waukon. Turning now to the regular notices, beginning in Cedar Rapids, Judy K. Roman Dennison, age 76, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Center Point, passed away Monday, March 11, and she was known as Just Judy. A service will be held at Murdoch Funeral Home, 622 Main Street in Center Point, Iowa, March 23 at 4:30 p.m., followed by a celebration of her life at the Center Point Public Library Community Room, 720 Main Street in Center Point. Please join us in remembering her life. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the Funeral Home website tribute page under Photos and Videos or Media, starting at 4:30 on March 23. Judy was born to Bert and Grace Roman on June 23, 1947, in Vinton, Iowa. She grew up in Van Horn, where she made lasting friendships with many classmates who remain her friends to this day. The family wishes to express heartfelt gratitude to the staff at Hospice of Mercy as well as to all the dear friends and family members who visited. Please share a memory of Judy at murdockfuneralhome.com. Also in Cedar Rapids, Muriel Hope Funk, age 91, passed away Tuesday, March 12, at the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. on Sunday, March 17, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. on Monday, March 18, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Burial will follow the service and take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Muriel was born October 25, 1932, in Dubuque, Iowa. She graduated from Dubuque Senior High and married Mark Francis Funk on February 19, 1955, in Dubuque. A special thank you to all the staff at Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon for their kindness and care of Muriel over this past year. Please share a memory at cedarmemorial.com. In Marengo, Kyla Klima, or Klima, age 35, passed away in a tragic car accident on Monday, March 11, outside Marengo. Visitation is from 4 to 7 on Thursday, March 14, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. Funeral service is at 10 a.m. on Friday, March 15, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service. Burial at Urbana Memorial Cemetery following services. Kyla would want everyone to dress in casual clothing. Please feel free to write a note or a special memory of Kyla to place it in the casket with her. Those unable to attend are invited to watch the service via live stream. Kyla was born July 30, 1988 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Dan and Rhonda Klima. She graduated from Linmar High School in 2006. From Independence, Bernadine Wilkinson, age 85, passed away peacefully surrounded by her family after a courageous battle with ovarian cancer, Tuesday, March 12, at the Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Bernadine Wilkinson was born October 31, 1938, at the family home near Lamont, Iowa, the fourth of 12 children to F.D. and Hazel Anderson Brown. She quickly became known as Babe to family and friends. Babe attended Byron Country School and graduated from Winthrop High School in 1956. Visitation will be held on Saturday, March 16th at 1 p.m., with services to follow at 2 p.m. at Reef Family Center in Independence. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family or to the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Please leave an online condolence at reeffamilycenter.com. In Monticello, Jan Byers was reunited with the love of his life on Thursday, March 7. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, March 18 at Sacred Heart Catholic Church with interment in the Sacred Heart Cemetery. Friends may call from 4 until 7 Sunday at the Getch Funeral Home, Monticello, where a parish scripture service will be held at 4 o'clock. Father Paul Baldwin will officiate at the services. Friends may call after 10 o'clock at the church on Monday. Thoughts, memories, and condolences can be left at getchonline.com. Jan Leroy Byers was born August 13, 1948 at Anamosa, Iowa, the son of Jack and Edna Allen Byers. Jan graduated from Anamosa Community Schools with the class of 1966. He worked at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids and later at Seven States Oil and APCO in Monticello. The majority of his working career was at Energy Manufacturing, where he was a machinist. In Iowa City, Joan Evans Frohwine Parsons, age 94, passed away March 12. Joan was preceded in death by her husband, C.H. Larry Parsons, and her parents. A private family memorial service will take place at a later date. A full obituary can be found at gayandchia.com. And lastly, in Cedar Rapids, Beverly Demery, age 85, passed away Wednesday, March 13, at Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids. Private family services will be held with entombment at the Linwood Cemetery Mausoleum in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Beverly was born April 6, 1938 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of John and Lucille, or Susie, Gregory Bezdek. She graduated from Wilson High School in 1956. Please share a memory at murdochfuneralhome.com. Turning now to the sports page, high school girls wrestling, girls falling in love with the nation's fastest growing sport. This is an AP story. Jody McHale was a sophomore at Pennsylvania's Cumberland Valley High School when a poster for a new girls wrestling club caught her eye, so McHale, a senior now, tried the sport. "I fell in love with it the first time," she said. Unlike previous generations, she's hardly alone. Girls wrestling has become the fastest growing high school sport in the country, sanctioned by a surging number of states and bolstered by a movement of medal-winning female wrestlers, parents, and the male-dominated ranks of coaches and administrators who saw it as a necessity and a matter of equality. Where once girls wrestled on boys' teams and against boys, increasingly they are wrestling on girls' teams and against girls. And now that they are wrestling in sanctioned and official tournaments against girls, their names are going onto plaques on their high school walls and into state record books. This year, Kentucky, Rhode Island, and Pennsylvania held their first state-sanctioned girls' wrestling championships, while Louisiana became the 45th state to sanction the sport. Iowa held its second state-sanctioned tournament with more teams and wrestlers than the year before. At the collegiate level, women's wrestling is designated as an emerging sport and is on track to become a championship-level sport in 2026, the NCAA said. The University of Iowa remains the lone Power Five school offering women's wrestling, however. In Pennsylvania, where the Penn State men are ranked number one, and the state's male and female wrestlers dominated last year's 16 and under national team championships, the number of girls wrestlers in high schools nearly doubled this year as the state rocketed to more than 180 high school teams from none in 2020. Hundreds of girls competed in Pennsylvania's first sanctioned state tournament, including McHale, after years of girls having no choice but to wrestle boys, or if they did wrestle girls, seeing the same handful of faces year after year in tournaments organized by local wrestling organizations. Even for girls who compete nationally or hope to wrestle in college, wrestling in state-sanctioned tournaments brings status. It really does bring this level of, I think, having girls feel seen, said Brooke Zumas, a former wrestling coach who was active in the movement to get the sport sanctioned in Pennsylvania. Girls who have competed for years are seeing new faces and big crowds in this year's state-sanctioned championship tournaments. "There were never tournaments like this," said Savannah Witt, a state champion wrestler. "It's awesome to see. I've been used to running into the same, like, three faces at tournaments. Now you come here and it's, I don't know half these girls." Over the past decade, the number of high school girls' teams quadrupled nationally, and the number of girls wrestling in high school quintupled to more than 50,000 through last year, according to figures from the National Federation of State High School Associations. Abbreviating that story, I'll turn to this by Jeff Johnson. In prep football, Addie named head football coach at Cedar Rapids, Washington. "Don't judge him by the win-loss record. Judge Eric Addie by what he was able to accomplish at a job that might be the toughest in the state. That'd be a definite culture change." Addie was announced late Wednesday afternoon as the new varsity head football coach at Cedar Rapids, Washington, pending school board approval. He has been at Des Moines North, his alma mater, which has a student population that has one of the highest free and reduced lunch rates and highest minority rate in Iowa. After five straight winless seasons, North won four times in 2022, the highest victory total the school has had since 1999. It won twice last season. Addie has helped develop a pair of D1 college players in Davon Hilson, Iowa, and David Calker, Iowa State. He is Assistant Activities Director at North, Weight Room Coordinator, and Activities Academic Interventionist at the school. Eric spent the last 5 seasons at Des Moines North and was able to re-energize and rebuild that football program, said a press release from Washington. His passion for working with student athletes and creating an engaging environment will allow Coach Addy to build on the Warriors' rich football heritage. Morris Blue stepped down as Washington head coach in December after 7 seasons. The Warriors went 1-8 this past season. I'm grateful, humbled, and excited to be named the head football coach at Washington High, Addy said in a press release. My family and I can't wait to become part of the Washington community. It's always a great day to be a Warrior. Turning now to the Things to Do Today column. In the museum and exhibit category, In Her Steps, Women's History Tours. Join this 90-minute staff-led specialty tour, which highlights the history of the estate and discusses themes of labor, class, and philanthropy. From the woman who built the mansion to the woman who gifted it to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, this tour offers unique insight into the women of Brucemoor. That takes place today from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Brucemoor, 2160 Linden Drive Southeast in Cedar Rapids, and the cost is $10 to $18. In the hobby category, tool care for yard and garden. Want to learn how to keep your hand, gas, or battery-powered tools sharp and light new? From shovels and hoes to mowers, trimmers, tillers, and pruners, Linn County Master Gardener Will Carew will discuss his favorite garden tools and their maintenance. That takes place at the Ladd Library, 3750 Williams Boulevard Southwest in Cedar Rapids. That is scheduled from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. today, and that is free. And air traffic controller from Boston has created a place all their own in the indie pop world. They are playing at the CSPS Hall, 7 to 10 p.m., and that's at 1103 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Tickets are $15 in advance or $20 at the door. Turning now to the Hoopla section. The photo on the front page of the Hoopla is a dog all dressed up for St. Paddy's Day. And the article is titled, It's Back, Baby! Sapada Paso Parade returns to the traditional March 17th date. This is by Diana Nolan. Everybody's Irish on St. Patrick's Day, decked out in their greenery from the top of the morning to the edge of night. To get an early start on the day's festivities, the Tycoon will open for one of the few times in the year at 8 a.m. March 17. The nearly wraparound windows facing 5th Street and 3rd Avenue Southeast offer prime indoor viewing of the Sapada Paso Parade, which is returning to its pre-pandemic tradition for snaking through downtown Cedar Rapids on St. Patrick's Day, regardless of where March 17 falls on the calendar. Part of the reason that we changed the date from on the day of St. Patrick's Day to the Saturday before was in hopes that we would be able to get more people to volunteer if it was on a Saturday morning, so they wouldn't have to take a day off work, said Chris Fail of Cedar Rapids, president of the St. Patrick's Day Parade Society, more commonly known as Sapada Paso. Moving the date didn't quite work, she added, noting attendance was down those years. The chilly days didn't help the crowd count either. This year's forecast is more favorable, with temperatures in the 50s. So even with sunshine predicted, spectators may want to grab a jacket, along with a chair or blanket, and a bag to hold all the goodies handed out along the parade route. It takes a wee village of 60 to 70 volunteers to staff the parade from the staging area to the route that begins on 6th Street Southeast, turns down 2nd Avenue, turns again on 2nd Street, and back up 3rd Avenue, ending at Green Square. Start time is 1 p.m. With the 70-plus entries, it will take at least an hour. We try to keep it moving so we don't run too long. Read more of the Gazette's interview in Sunday's edition in print and online at thegazette.com. Lots of bars and restaurants will be serving up Irish brews and dishes for St. Patrick's Day, but here's a look at some of the activities sure to put a jig in your step. Friday, Flanagan's Wake, March 15 to 17, Starlighters 2, 200 East Main Street in Anamosa, 7:30 p.m. Friday, Saturday at 2 p.m. Or excuse me, that is 7:30 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, 2 p.m. on Sunday. In this comedy improv show, audiences see the folks in the beautiful fictional village of Graplin, County Sligo, Ireland, as they tell tales, sing songs, and mourn the passing of one of their own, Flanagan. Shamrock and Bowl After Dark, 10 to midnight, March 15 and 16 at the spare time, includes 2 hours of unlimited bowling. That's $14.99 per person. Wear something green and get a $10 game card. On Saturday, Big Grove St. Patrick's Weekend Party, 9 a.m. March 16 and 17 at the Big Grove Brewery in Cedar Rapids. The St. Patrick's Day Mass and Parade, 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. in Dyersville. The church celebration will take place at 10:30 a.m. at St. Francis Xavier Basilica. The parade there starts at 1:30 p.m. through downtown. They also are hosting a 5K run walk, a 12-mile bike ride, Ancient Order of Hibernians annual banquet, and that's at the Knights of Columbus Hall in Dyersville. There's an Irish music jam at the Czech Village from 2 to 5 p.m. on March 16, Lionbridge Brewing Company, live Irish music, traditional bangers and mash, and a World Beer Cup winner, Old 17 Irish Stout. Free Irish dance performance and mini lessons will take place at 3:15 on March 17 at the Cedar Rapids Public Library by Champagne Academy of Irish Dance. And the Groove Party, or excuse me, the Groove Garden, St. Paddy's Day edition, from 3 to 6 p.m. on March 17 at the Ideal Theater and Bar. Live Irish music by Kellen O'Callum will be at 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. on March 17th at the Lionbridge Brewing Company, again in the Czech Village in Cedar Rapids. You can view these activities and others online at the Cedar Rapids Gazette. In the food category, Cakewalk is the title of this article by Elijah Desius. A Cedar Rapids couple has swapped part-time cupcake deliveries for a full-time bakery with a new opening in Newbo City Market. KC Cakes, which opened at the market in November and repositioned to a larger spot in February, is growing about as fast as the cakes rise in the oven. But a few years after they started from scratch at home, for owners Kristen Proctor and Alex Cooley, it's more than cakes. For mother, Kristen Proctor, baking started at home long before she was a mother. "I've been baking as long as I can remember," she said. "My family is hardcore Czechoslovakian. My mom grew up making kolaches by hand. It's something I've always liked to do." But when she became a mom herself at 19, the interest was reborn as a way to bond with her daughter. Instead of making kolaches, she channeled her energy into cakes that allowed her to put her artistic flair into more complicated desserts. "As a young mom, I wanted her to have the best. I'd bake her all these elaborate cakes," Proctor said. But when the pandemic hit, the need for something from scratch took on a new meaning. With her children and Cooley, the couple turned Cooley's DoorDash delivery route into a cakewalk of sorts, selling six-packs of basic cupcakes and building an online following the way many foodies did in 2021. After a spinal surgery, Cooley was forced to retire from his work in construction. "My doctor told me that if I go back to construction, I may never walk again," he said. With some experience as a Newbo City Market guest vendor, Proctor swapped burning the candle at both ends, bartending and baking overnight, for a full-time business that's grown past the basics. Now with mini cakes, cheesecakes, brownies, and a variety of cookie types, both Proctor and Cooley have grown a following that has outpaced their business projections. Served in pink aluminum tins, their signature mini cakes are about a cupcake and a half, with a heaping of icing, decorations, and sometimes fillings that go beyond what the structure of a cupcake can offer. Today, Proctor loves to embellish the treats through buttercream, ganache, and more. Most cakes are a modified base of recipes passed down through generations in her family, and most offer some form of trendy twist that coexists well with tradition, even the basics like Oreo cupcakes. In brief, it is called KC Cakes. They are located at the Nouveau City Market, 1100 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Hours for KC Cakes are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursday and Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday. They have a Facebook presence, KC Cakes CR, and they provide mini cakes, cheesecakes, brownies, cookies, and more, starting at $3. Custom orders are available. Finishing up today with a brief look at the weather, we're looking for a high of 56 today and a low of 36. Showers and storm likely, with the wind out of the northeast, 20 to 30 miles per hour. Looking for mostly sunny skies tomorrow and partly cloudy Saturday and Sunday, and those temperatures staying in that 50-degree range. The normal high for today is 45, the normal low is 26. A record high of 75 degrees was set in 2012, a record low of 6 degrees below zero was set in 1960. Sunset tonight is at 7:13 p.m., and sunrise tomorrow at 7:18 a.m. That gives us 11 hours and 54 minutes of daylight. And we are in the waxing crescent moon phase, with moonrise at 9:31 and set at 1:02. That does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can access a copy of today's reading online. I've been your reader, Kathleen. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.